46-year-old Teresa Sievers was a healer. Living near a Florida beach town, Teresa had set up a holistic medical practice to care for her patients. Many of them said they felt left behind by modern medicine. Using Eastern philosophy, the Bonita Springs doctor believed in treating their whole being by paying attention to the body's energy flow and spirit. She was devoted to her patients who prayed with her and loved her. The holistic doctor didn't focus on building a clientele of the wealthy. According to those who knew her, she was compassionate and wanted to make a difference. She provided free medical care for the homeless and worked with pregnant teenagers who underwent trauma.
I used to call her my modern-day Mother Teresa.
Teresa was a rising star, and it wasn't hard to see why. She was a magnetic and confident doctor who stood out for her petite size. She was under 5 feet tall.
Hi, I'm Dr. Teresa Sievers. And as I promised you, I was going to be bringing you different modalities of healing. I think it's so exciting for people to find new ways of preventative health.
Teresa seemed to be on the verge of a big break and landed a television show called Pathways to Healing. She had filmed several episodes, but the television show would never air.
She wanted to awaken and enlighten the world. And when she would be defeated from the obstacles that would cut in her way and things weren't happening fast enough for her, she would call me up and cry, "Mom, why is this taking so long? I have so much to say." And I would say to her, "Teresa, you're doing great. And I know you will reach the masses." And she did. I just never dreamed it would be this way.
In June 2015, Dr. Teresa Sievers was murdered. But by whom?
A brutal murder and nothing taken from the home. A brutal murder and no trail, no ties to any suspects. It will take time, some of the latest technology, long hours, perseverance by law enforcement to solve the mystery of why Teresa Sievers was murdered and who murdered her.
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 126. Here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support. So while there are a lot of options out there, there's only one no-brainer, SimpliSafe. My family is a SimpliSafe family. We've been using their security system for years now, and I feel incredibly safe with it. SimpliSafe's got everything you need to protect your home with none of the drawbacks of traditional home security. It's got an arsenal of sensors and cameras to cover every room, window, and door tailored specifically for your home. Professional monitoring keeps watch day and night, ready to send police, fire, or medical professionals if there's an emergency. And what's really cool is that you can set it up yourself in under an hour. Just peel and stick the sensors exactly where you need them. No technician required. And there's no contract, no pushy sales guys, no hidden fees, no fine print. And their pricing is great too. All this, everything I just said, starts at just $15 a month. And I'm not the only one who thinks SimpliSafe is great. U.S. News and World Report named it the best overall home security of 2020. Try SimpliSafe today at simplisafe.com/court. You get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. There's nothing to lose. It's really a no-brainer. That's simplisafe.com/court. Americans might be ready to get back to work, but to win in the new economy, you need every advantage to succeed. Smart companies run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. With NetSuite, you'll have visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need all in one place. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in sales, NetSuite lets you manage every penny with precision, You'll have the ability to compete with anyone, work from anywhere, and run your whole company right from your phone. Join over 20,000 companies who trust NetSuite to make it happen. NetSuite surveyed hundreds of business leaders and assembled a playbook of the top strategies they're using as America reopens for business. Receive your free guide, 7 Actions Businesses Need to Take Now, and schedule your free product tour at netsuite.com/court. Get your free guide and schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/court. That's netsuite.com/court. This is a brutal murder. Those were the words of Assistant State Attorney Cynthia Ross while giving opening statements at the start of the trial in November 2019. She painted for the jury a gruesome image of Teresa's death. By the time Teresa was found bludgeoned to death on her kitchen floor on June 29, 2015, her body was already cold. Her death had been a violent one. Her head rested in a pool of blood, with a medical examiner counting 17 impact wounds on her skull. A hinge fracture ran from one side of her skull to the other. Who would kill the beloved doctor who was a married mother of 2 daughters? There was no clear motive since she hadn't been robbed. The house hadn't been ransacked, and $50,000 in cash was left untouched, hidden in the family's home. Teresa's husband, Mark, and the couple's 2 daughters had been out of town when the murder occurred. It seemed as though Mark shared the same empathetic background as his wife. Growing up, Mark saved up his allowance to buy diamond earrings for his sister so she would know what it was like to own a piece of nice jewelry. He journaled as a teenager. As an adult, he became a licensed registered nurse and cared for his 102-year-old grandfather, who needed daily insulin shots. Some called Mark Smiley because of his bubbly personality. Many believed he and Teresa complemented each other perfectly. The couple lived on Jarvis Road in a white 4-bedroom house with a pool that was a short drive from Bonita Beach and about 30 minutes north of Naples, Florida. Mark's mother, Bonnie Seavers, remembered how Mark was a devoted father to the couple's 2 daughters.
He was very hands-on. He was the stay-at-home dad. He also worked at the Teresa's office, managed that and so forth. But as the father, he would get involved in all the girls' activities, taught them how to swim, and then got them swimming lessons. When the girls were older, and he encouraged them to be whatever they wanted to do, and they wanted to sing and dance and act, and they were in plays. And Mark volunteered to work behind the scenes where they had painting or help building the sets or whatever. He always taught them how, and so did Teresa, about virtues and what's right and what's wrong, and to talk about feelings. And it was really very good at that, and very loving.
Now, the 2 little girls had lost their mother. The community reacted swiftly to Teresa's death. Detectives canvassed the neighborhood. 30 people lined up within an arm's reach of each other to search for evidence up and down streets. But their efforts were futile. They didn't find a murder weapon or any bloody items or evidence from the crime scene. The police investigation dragged on for 8 months until they finally arrested who they believed was the mastermind behind Teresa's death. The murder case was like a complex jigsaw puzzle, the assistant state attorney described as authorities found evidence, piece by piece, that explained what had happened. The case led investigators on a cross-country road trip far from Bonita Springs.
How did this come to light? Why this murder? And how do we know now what we do know? Like a puzzle with hundreds of pieces, or maybe 1,000 pieces, one piece at a time, one corner put together at a time, two pieces connected. And like a puzzle, the initial pieces placed on the board don't seem to connect to each other. They seem to have no visual connection. It took time.
It had been a random phone call one night while Lee County Sheriff's investigators worked late in the office. A Port Authority police chief from Illinois knew someone who knew something. The tip was convincing enough, so investigators flew to Illinois in July 2015, 1 month after Teresa's death. They stayed in Illinois for 12 days, and they spoke with a woman named Rose Grunner. Who Rose actually is remains unclear. So is what she told authorities. She was never called as a witness at any trial, and Lieutenant Michael Downs of the Lee County Sheriff's Office didn't reveal many details of their conversation when he testified. Rose didn't mention a murder, but she did tell authorities a name they hadn't heard before, Curtis Wayne Wright Jr. That would send the Florida authorities on another cross-country trip, this time to Missouri. They were able to track Curtis down and interview him. He denied any involvement in the murder, but he did have quite a connection to the Seavers. He was Mark Seavers' best friend. Pieces of the puzzle were perhaps starting to fit. Looking through Curtis's cell phone records, authorities locked in another name, Jimmy Rogers.
Being that Curtis Wayne Wright became a person of interest in the investigation, our primary focus at this point in based on what we were doing, we were trying to get as much background as possible on him and get an idea of who he was, who he spoke to, things of that nature. In doing that, Jimmy Ray Rogers' name came up, so we went to go speak with him to see if we could obtain any further information.
Investigators obtained a search warrant and went to Jimmy's rundown trailer. Jimmy wasn't home, but his live-in girlfriend, Taylor Shoemaker, was. The sheriff's investigators explained they were looking for evidence. They were there for a reason, and it was better to help them than hide anything. It worked. Taylor was instantly helpful. She pointed out a red Budweiser t-shirt, a black backpack, and a white cooler that Jimmy had packed with gloves, a hammer, and shoes. All items from a recent Florida road trip he went on with none other than Curtis Wayne Wright. She also led the investigators to a rural road 30 minutes from Jimmy's trailer. There was a discarded blue jumpsuit. Taylor said Jimmy had asked her to throw the coveralls off of a bridge into the water, but she missed and it fell on the ground nearby. On the jumpsuit was evidence connecting to the crime scene that was almost invisible to the human eye.
FBI analysis and analysts that, with the latest equipment and amazing resources, provided the link between small, almost microscopic fibers found on Teresa Seaver's leg in the kitchen floor and in the rental car driven by Wright and Rogers. Fibers that connected to overalls found, thrown away on a rural road in Missouri. FBI analysis that would link a broken piece of hair no bigger than the width of a nickel to Rogers. A GPS seized pursuant to the search warrant of Curtis Wayne Wright's residence back in July of 2015. Well, because of the ability of the digital forensics unit at the Lee County Sheriff's Office, they were able to retrieve overwritten and deleted information, which showed from that Garmin, which showed a trip to Jarvis Road the weekend of the murder.
A massive data dump from cell phone towers also played an important part in the investigation. Another one of the puzzle pieces.
In 2015, the cell tower that was nearest to Jarvis Road, during the period of time from when Teresa Seaver's phone, as she was driving home from the airport, connected to the Wi-Fi, and her body was found about 10 hours later. In that period of time, over 98,000 numbers were recorded on that cell tower. 98,000 numbers.
Unlike prepaid phones or a person's cell phone, burner phones aren't tied to a person's name.
So how does the Lee County Sheriff's Office or any analyst sit there and review 98,000 pages of numbers? They do it with 21st century technology. And for the Lee County Sheriff's Office, it was a program called CellHawk.
They uploaded the data and mapped it out by the area codes. Investigators zeroed in on Georgia and California. Curtis had told authorities he remembered buying a phone with a Georgia area code before he happened to get rid of it. Lieutenant Downs picked California on a random gut guess. He ended up being right. They picked AT&T as a provider because, as one prosecutor said, you had to start somewhere.
She ran in a few searches, and when she put in a search for the area code 404, a Georgia area code, a number popped. And that 404 number had pinged off of the cell tower near Jarvis Road at 11:37 p.m., the night of the murder.
It was the spark. The discovery turned the focus to another cell tower and more data. The same 404 phone number also pinged off a tower near where Curtis lived in Missouri in May, weeks before the murder. Through the 404 phone records, authorities zeroed in on another burner phone number, a California one. The two Georgia and California phones were in a flurry of communication for a short period of time, only with each other, and then went quiet in the summer of 2015. A suspicious pattern, investigators thought. The Georgia phone number pinged off the same tower at the same time as Curtis's personal phone. With evidence mounting, Jimmy was unwilling to cooperate with prosecutors. He was currently already in jail, arrested for violating his probation for his trip to Florida. He would soon face more serious charges in connection to Teresa's death. Lee County Sheriff's Lieutenant David Lebed tried to persuade Jimmy to cooperate while he was in custody.
And so he wanted to know what his charges were, or he was leaving. What did you tell him?
I said homicide, second-degree murder.
And when you told him what the charges were, did he then agree to talk to you?
No, he did not.
What did he do?
He briefly said, well, in the state of Missouri, it's 15 to 20 years, and I'm okay with that. And I immediately tried to talk over him and say, let's talk about this, but he left.
Jimmy decided to take his chances at trial and was ultimately convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison in 2019. The second and final trial in the case would take place just months later. There's never a bad time to save money, but now, more than ever, finding smart ways to put some cash back in your pocket can make a big difference. One way to do that is to simply save on the things you already pay for, like home insurance. If you own a home, reshopping your home insurance rates with Policy Genius could save you a good chunk of change. And the best part is, you barely need to lift a finger to do it. Here's how. First, head to policygenius.com and answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then, Policy Genius will compare your policy against options from top insurers to make sure you're getting the right home insurance coverage at the best possible price. If Policy Genius finds you a better rate than what you're currently paying, they'll do all the work to get you switched. If you own a car too, Policy Genius will compare your home and auto policies across different insurers, and even mix and match to find you savings. They've saved their customers an average of $1,127 per year doing just that. So if you'd like to put a little cash back in your pocket right now, see how much you can save by reshopping your home insurance rates at policygenius.com. Unraveling the testimony in a criminal case is kind of like a puzzle. Each connection helps reveal the big picture, and it's a thrill to put it all together. When I'm not thinking about true crime, my brain still craves a challenge. That's why I love Best Fiends. Best Fiends is the fun and exciting puzzle adventure you can experience anytime, anywhere. You don't even need an internet connection to play. No Wi-Fi, no worries. And if you're looking for a fun way to have a socially distant competition with your friends right now, then you gotta try playing Best Fiends. My friend Christy Lee, over at the podcast Canadian True Crime, and I can't hang out in person, but we have been competing in Best Fiends. My favorite part about Best Fiends is how visual it is and how adorable all the little characters are. I like to play it after my daughter goes to bed for the night and when she naps. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Curtis Wainwright Jr. was in love and was getting married again. He and his fiancée, Angie, decided on a springtime wedding outside at a park in Missouri. Before their big day, Curtis received a vague text message from his best man, his good friend, Mark Sievers. It was a text that had nothing to do with the upcoming festivities. Mark was flying in the next day from his home in South Florida to Missouri for the wedding. Mark and Curtis had known each other since they were teenagers, and in adulthood, they had stayed close and confided in each other as Curtis went through some hard times. Curtis had been charged with multiple felonies and had served time. His previous two marriages had fallen apart. He was in a car crash that took a toll on his physical and mental health. Curtis and Mark bore an uncanny resemblance to each other. It was hard to tell them apart. They both had bald, egg-shaped heads and goatees, and sometimes they wore glasses. Hopefully we can talk privately tomorrow, not about you or Angie, but it's personal. Mark had texted as Curtis's mind was on other matters, his wedding. After Mark arrived in town and after Curtis finally got some alone time to talk with them further, they closed the door in Curtis's bedroom, away from the chaos of wedding guests coming in and out. And then Mark shared the somber news. In a soft-spoken voice, Curtis recounted the conversation on the stand.
He told me that he and Teresa were having problems, marital problems. He told me that she was having an affair, and that they were having financial problems as well, considering bankruptcy.
Did you believe Mr. Sievers when he was telling you these things?
Yes.
Did you have any proof that she was having an affair or that they were having any financial problems or anything like that?
No.
You took his word for it?
Yes.
What else did he tell you?
We talked a little bit about, you know, just different options. It was a short conversation because we got interrupted. At one point he said a hypothetical situation where, if kids were going to be taken away and put into some kind of danger, that if I knew somebody that would be willing to help them.
Help them how?
We didn't get into the specifics, but my take on it at the time was maybe to have this guy run off, beat up, something.
So you thought that Mr. Sievers was hypothetically asking if you knew somebody who could beat somebody up for him?
Yes.
The next morning, Curtis and Mark were getting dressed for Curtis's wedding. Curtis said Mark wanted to keep talking about his failing marriage.
He brought the situation back up. This time he told me that Teresa was actually leaving him. The night before, it was just that she was having an affair. So at this point, it's getting a little more involved. He said that she was actually leaving him. She was taking the children and taking them out of state.
Mark couldn't fight for the kids since he wasn't in good financial shape. Counseling couldn't save the marriage. Curtis said he listened to his longtime friend as best as he could as he dealt with the pandemonium of a do-it-yourself wedding. Some of the food was missing for the reception dinner, a potential wedding disaster. Curtis and Mark were alone again in the car as they tracked down the misplaced box of meat. Curtis said Mark felt like he had run out of choices.
He told me that really the only option that he had was for her to die. And he said that he needed to have her killed.
Okay, so on your wedding day, on your drive to pick up meat for your wedding, Mr. Severs is telling you that he wants to have his wife killed.
Yes, he asked me to help him.
I mean, what kind of help was he asking for? Was he asking you to do it yourself or what? Like, what kind of help could he be possibly asking his friend for?
Well, it was pretty direct. He asked me to, if I would kill her or take care of it.
Curtis said he was stunned, but Mark had been there through Curtis's legal problems. He was going to stand up at Curtis's wedding. Now he wanted a favor. According to Curtis, he wanted his wife dead ASAP.
Were the two of you that close, Mr. Wright, that, I mean, Mr. Severs could ask you to kill his wife and you would actually consider it?
Yes. I mean, definitely the asking part. I question whether or not actually doing it should have been part of the friendship, but
Curtis didn't think he was capable of murder, but he promised to see what he could do. And then he walked down the aisle. Curtis said Mark offered him at least $100,000, which was enticing to him because he was having money problems. He was disabled after he had experienced a traumatic brain injury in that car crash. He lived more than 1,000 miles away from Florida, but remotely, he maintained the software used by the Severs medical practice, although that wasn't a lavish paycheck by any means. Within a few weeks, Curtis said he had made up his mind. He was willing to help out his best friend. He also decided he didn't want to kill Teresa alone. He enlisted help, turning to Jimmy Ray Rogers, who was more than 2 decades younger and appeared to have a sinister past. His self-given nickname was Jimmy the Hammer. Curtis had befriended Jimmy when they served in county jail in 2010, and 5 years later, they lived fairly close to each other. Jimmy attended Curtis's wedding, too.
How did Jimmy Rogers get involved?
A little bit of background. Jimmy has let me know in the past that he's
overruled.
Jimmy has let me know in the past that his past criminal activity, that he's been involved in things like this. So the only person that I know that might have wanted to be involved in this would have been Jimmy. So that's why the 2 week period was significant, because I got my cell phone, my other phone, the anonymous phone. We referred to them as our other phones, just so that you kind of keep it straight. I got my other phone on May 17th, and I got it right after I spoke to Jimmy. I went and talked to Jimmy in person and told him that, you know, there was a job, you know, not specifics about who or anything, but made sure that it was something he wanted to get involved in. He was on board. So
Jimmy Rogers is a contract killer?
I don't know that I would call him that, but I know that he's been involved in other deaths. So
you thought he was some kind of tough guy?
Well, I believe that he was somebody that would actually do it, so.
Curtis said he planned to split the cash payment with Jimmy, while also keeping Mark and Jimmy's identities secret from one another. Mark wouldn't know who Jimmy was, and Jimmy wouldn't know who Mark was. According to Curtis, he and Mark needed to find the right time and place for Teresa's death. Mark warned he didn't want anyone to witness the murder, according to Curtis's testimony. Mark instructed that any unlucky passerby who happened to be with Teresa should end up as collateral damage, which Curtis said made him feel uncomfortable about attacking Teresa at her office. He didn't want to be responsible for any other deaths. He was leaning towards an attack at her house. That summer, the opportunity became more clear. Teresa's mother was celebrating her 75th birthday, and the family rented a house on a lake in New Windsor, New York. The weekend was one of the happiest moments in Marianne's life since her daughter, Teresa, and her three other adult children could all be together for the occasion. They took a family photograph to remember the moment. The Seavers family had staggered flights home. Teresa flew home alone late on that Sunday night, June 28, 2015, in order to be back in time for work on Monday morning. Mark and the couple's two daughters stayed 3 extra days. Curtis said this was Mark's alibi, but it also guaranteed that he and his children would not get hurt. It set into motion the opportunity for Teresa to be caught alone and unguarded. Despite their plans to commit a felony murder, Curtis and Jimmy carefully obeyed the law when it came to guns and their felony records. They weren't willing to drive across the country with guns, which would land them in more trouble.
Are you supposed to have a gun?
No, I'm a felon. So,
I mean, you're not supposed to kill people either, but you're not supposed to have a gun.
No,
are you?
No. And okay. So from the very beginning, when the gun was brought up, I mean, I don't own a gun, and I'm not going to be traveling across state lines with a gun in the car. So.
Was Mr. Rogers also a felon?
Yes.
So driving from Missouri to Florida with gun or guns in a car, is that a good idea for the both of you?
No.
They rented a car and left at 8 a.m. on Saturday, June 27th, 2015, gun-free. Instead of bringing a bathing suit, Jimmy brought along 2 pairs of one-piece blue coveralls, the kind a painter might wear. He also packed latex gloves and industrial duct tape, which Curtis explained matter-of-factly that would help hide the evidence. Their plan, which he said was thanks to Mark's idea, was to find something at the house to kill Teresa with, to make it seem as though she had the tragic misfortune of walking in during the middle of a burglary. Curtis figured a knife would suffice. They drove through the night, stopping for gas and to use the bathroom. At 6 a.m. on Sunday, they reached their destination in the Sunshine State and pulled off the highway at the exit for Mark and Teresa's house. It was the first time Jimmy had ever seen the property, although Curtis had visited several times over the years. Curtis testified that Mark wanted them to climb over the backyard privacy fence and enter the house through the garage side door. Just before Mark left for the trip, Curtis said he did yard work.
And he said that he trimmed back all that brush to make sure that nobody got scratched and left blood or something. So he said that he actually went over it himself to make sure that it was realistic.
With the Seavers family gone, the two men proceeded into the quiet house. Curtis introduced Jimmy to the Seavers' dogs. They scouted out the layout. Jimmy kept his eye out for expensive items to take, since he was aware the insurance payout could take weeks or months after Teresa's death.
Jimmy was kind of poking around stuff, found a hammer in one of Mark's toolboxes and made a crude joke about it being Teresa's destiny, made a hammering.
Their first house visit was cut short because they had reason to be cautious. Mark's mother was stopping by twice a day to care for the pets. They wanted to avoid her. Curtis and Jimmy planned to return in the dark that night. Teresa's flight was due in at 11:25 p.m. At least that's what Mark's instructions had said, Curtis testified. They had hours to pass. They dipped their ankles into the ocean water, stopped at Walmart, and got food. They drove by Teresa's medical office, which Curtis felt was too exposed. They were less focused on the specifics of what lay ahead.
At this time, had you yet come up with a plan for how it was that Dr. Seavers was supposed to die?
No, not a set plan.
You and Mr. Rogers had driven down here over a day or so, had been gone from Missouri for more than 24 hours, and the two of you hadn't yet come up with a plan about how Dr. Seavers was going to die?
Well, there were two main plans in place, but those were brought to me from Mark. So those were plans that Mark and I had established. I had shared those with Jimmy, but there were variables that were in there. Like which vehicle she was going to be driving, you know, as far as like how she entered the garage, if it happened at work. When the trip got planned for out of town, that made the most sense. It became the house was really the most probable, you know, place, but it wasn't set in stone. It was like, okay, here's the two houses prepped. You got everything you need for the office. As long as it's done before I get back, it's up to you to make the call once you're here.
At 10:30 p.m., Curtis and Jimmy returned to the Seavers home for the second time that day. They put on their coveralls, gloves, and waited by the side door for Teresa to arrive. Curtis intentionally damaged the side door, which had been unlocked, to fit the narrative that this was a botched home invasion and it looked as if the door was pried open. With Mark Seavers listening on in the courtroom, Curtis described how he also wanted to make Teresa's death look like an accident.
My intention was to, this may sound strange, but to put her in a chokehold, which isn't choking somebody, but it cuts the blood off. So the person passes out pretty quickly.
Then, once Teresa was unconscious, they could kill her. Even the prosecutor sounded stunned at how poorly conceived the murder plot was.
Well, Mr. Wright, now, in the 11 o'clock hour on June 28th, you're at least less than an hour away from having to kill Dr. Seavers, as per Mr. Seavers' request. And you still didn't have an idea of exactly how it was supposed to happen?
We had, there was probably three ideas. Like I said, we did, you know, we should have been better prepared. We weren't.
According to Curtis, unexpected problems were arising. Curtis forgot Teresa's flight information, so he couldn't confirm if her plane was delayed or not. The 11:25 p.m. arrival time he said Mark had given him wasn't actually when her flight landed. He said Mark had calculated her drive time home from the airport as well. So Curtis was surprised when Teresa's van pulled into the driveway 25 minutes earlier than they had expected. Jimmy was inside looking for items to steal, while he stood admiring Mark's motorcycle. He had a one-track mind, he said, which appeared to be from his brain injury. When the garage doors opened and the garage light popped on, leaving him exposed. Any extra minutes that Curtis and Jimmy had to finally lock down their plan disappeared. Curtis dove behind boxes to avoid Teresa's headlights. He knew he was vulnerable to being discovered. He stayed hidden, listening to the sounds. The sound of the van door opening, the sound of the luggage dragging, the sound of a door opening. He knew Teresa was inside the house. He panicked. Spontaneously, he picked up a hammer from on top of the freezer in the garage. He followed her inside the house, but he accidentally tripped over the dog water dish. Teresa, sensing someone was behind her, turned around. Curtis hit her on the head with the hammer. Teresa tried to defend herself. He testified that she raised her hands up. Nearly 4 years later, Curtis told of the final seconds of Teresa's life in the Lee County courtroom. Teresa's family members began weeping and covered their faces with their hands. Mark Seavers teared up and wiped his eyes too. It was November 2019, and 51-year-old Mark Seavers was on trial, facing charges of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Curtis Wayne Wright was the state's star witness. He had pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in 2016 and had accepted a 25-year plea deal for cooperating, first in Jimmy's trial and now in Mark's.
She fought?
Yes.
She fought for her life?
Yeah, she was surprised. I actually think that she thought I was Mark. She said, why?
Why would Dr. Seavers think that you were Mark Seavers?
We look, maybe not right now, but at the time and in the past, we look really a lot alike. And I had a hat on that was just like one of the hats that he wears, so.
Curtis began swinging. Then there were two. Jimmy appeared with a hammer, the same one he had joked about earlier. He attacked Teresa, who put one hand on the countertop to brace herself, and then fell to the floor. Jimmy kept hitting her as she lay face down on the floor. Curtis testified he told Jimmy to stop.
And when did he stop?
When he kept hitting her on the floor, I asked him a couple of times, you know, I said, Jimmy, stop, you know, is it enough? And but he wouldn't stop, so I actually went over there and put my hand on his shoulder and just like, you know, like, stop, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. When you said, Jimmy, stop, was it because you didn't want Teresa Seavers to be dead or was some other reason why you wanted him to stop?
It was just too much. I mean, she would have been dead no matter what happened because that was the intentions we went down there. What we were hired to do, but not like that.
The crime scene was gruesome. Curtis knew there was no way authorities would mistake it for a botched robbery, other than what it was. By the time Teresa's body was found, Curtis and Jimmy had already left Florida in their rental car, following the GPS back to Missouri. Dr. Mark Patrice received two strange voicemails. He was good friends with Teresa, a professional working relationship that started in 1995 during their residency program in Baltimore. After he moved to Florida, he went to parties with Teresa, who sometimes referred patients to him. But he wasn't particularly close with Mark Seavers, who unexpectedly called him in June, twice, and left two odd voicemails. The first was on Sunday. Mark said he wanted to check up on Dr. Patrice, out of the blue, and reminded him that Teresa would be home soon.
Hey, Mark. This is also Mark. I'm just calling to check on you, see how you're doing. I was texting with Michelle, and she said you already made it back safely. And for Myers, I just wanted to... Anyway, you got the idea. I will talk to you later. Teresa comes back tonight. And then the girls now will be back on Wednesday night. Just wanted to say hello and see how you're doing. Take care, Mark. Bye.
Then, the next morning, Mark Seavers called again. And this time, something appeared to be wrong.
This is Mark. I called yesterday just to check on you. Now I'm calling you today to see if you can check on Teresa. I know it's early, 9:30 in the morning, and you're probably at work, and that's okay. Teresa's not at work yet. And the office is calling and texting, and we can't get through to Teresa. So I just thought maybe if you were not at work, you could possibly swing by the house. And the garage code is 1313, enter, and then the door opens up. Anyway, if you get this message, great. Otherwise, I'll call my mom and come over and check on Teresa. Maybe she's just sound asleep. It's just not like her. You know, in all the years I've known her to be a half hour late for work and not answer her phone. Actually, the phone is kind of normal for me, but
Dr. Patrice did as he was asked. He went into the house calling Teresa's name. Within a few steps, he saw the scene. The blood, Teresa's lifeless body, and her massive head wound. He knew instantly that she was dead. He yelled for her daughters, unsure if they were still inside. And then he hurried outside to call 911. First, though, he called Mark Seavers back and asked where the girls were.
He said that they were with him, and I told him that he needed to come home now, and that I would call him back.
Did you tell him why he needed to come home now?
No, I did not.
Did he ask you why he needed to come home now?
No, he did not.
Dr. Patrice then called 911. He wasn't sure if the murderer was hiding in the house. He had noticed the piece of luggage still in the garage from Teresa's trip. Dr. Patrice was back on the phone with Mark as he asked him questions about Teresa's flight information to relay to the police. He didn't feel comfortable telling Mark over the phone that his wife was dead. Something that personal and tragic needed to be done face to face, he thought. So he only said Teresa had been seriously hurt. Mark asked if there had been a robbery. He didn't ask how Teresa was hurt or which hospital the paramedics were taking her to. Teresa's best friend, Danielle Berardelli, was also bothered by Mark's behavior. At the news of Teresa's death, Danielle jumped on a plane to Florida from her home in New Mexico. Mark came to greet her in the hotel room where she was staying.
We hugged immediately, and then he sounded as though he were crying.
Well, you're making a distinction there that you said he sounded like he was crying.
I say that because he sounded like he was crying and his body was quaking like he was crying. But when we looked at each other, I was searching his face and there were no tears, no red eyes, no runny nose. Not like my face or Anne's face or her brother's faces. I was taken aback because, you know, I thought our first words would be about the void that Teresa was going to leave as a mother and as a wife and as a friend and or like the who or the why, the how. But instead, we had a conversation about who was going to take care of the children in the event that he could not. And then we talked about the life insurance policy.
Danielle was the godmother to the Seavers' children. In the past, Mark assured her the girls would always be well taken care of since Teresa had a large life insurance policy. Now, in the hotel room, Mark seemed to forget all about the insurance money as he lamented to Danielle how he was worried about keeping his family afloat financially now that Teresa was gone and his nurse certification lapsed if he wasn't around. Danielle reminded him of the life insurance policy, although she doubted it had ever escaped his mind. Danielle talked to Mark every day on the phone after she returned home to New Mexico.
He also talked or expressed concern about the police questioning him and whether or not people thought he was a suspect. And so we also talked about the fact that if I spoke to him every day, and this was said, that, you know, he could be arrested at any time. He was concerned about that. He could be arrested in the middle of the night. If we talked every day, then I would know if something happened and then I could make immediate arrangements to be in Florida to get there as quickly as possible.
Prosecutors also presented evidence that the burner phone with the California area code that had been communicating with Curtis's Georgia burner phone pinged off the same towers at the same time as Mark's personal phone. According to Curtis, that burner phone belonged to Mark, and that's how they would communicate when planning the murder, on their burner phones. But despite that testimony, and despite Danielle and other friends testifying about Mark's peculiar behavior after his wife's murder, there's no rule book that spells out how a person is supposed to act after losing a spouse. Grieving is a complicated human emotion after all. Mark's defense attorney defended his behavior.
The state would like you to believe that there is some kind of a protocol, that there is some kind of a checklist that you go down on your spouse's murder, that there's a group of people that you have to call first or at all, that your life is not turned inside out, upside down on its head.
Prosecutors were lumping Mark Sievers in with Jimmy and Curtis, according to Mark's attorney, Michael Mummert. He also argued that Mark had no financial motive to gain from Teresa's death. Considering her line of work as a medical doctor, Teresa was underinsured. She was about to gain a higher profile from her upcoming television show. It didn't make sense for Mark to want to kill her, he said.
Ultimately, it is our position that Teresa Sievers was worth more alive than dead.
The defense called Monica Lyons, an expert on wills, trusts, and estates, to the stand. She testified that she helped Mark and Teresa with their life insurance policies years before Teresa's death. She said they signed an agreement that the money from their life insurance policy, valued at $2.5 million, would be put into an irrevocable trust fund upon Teresa's death. She compared Teresa to Oprah and said her profile was growing, that she was going to be successful, and she needed more life insurance. But on cross, she detailed another policy Teresa had, this one in the amount of $300,000, and of which Mark was the beneficiary. Another defense witness was Lieutenant David Lebed, who had also laid out the details of their investigation for the prosecution. This time, he was asked about another suspect he initially believed was involved, Curtis's new wife, Angie. Angie had an active prepaid phone around the time of Teresa's death, and she had to be told to stop talking to potential witnesses in the case. Curtis was also recalled to the stand. The defense showed text messages between him and Mark, including one he sent to Mark 2 days after Teresa's murder. It said, "I just talked to Scott and he told me what happened. I am so sorry." The defense also questioned the motives of Taylor Shoemaker, now the ex-girlfriend of Jimmy Rogers. She told the Lee County Sheriff's Office that she was in financial troubles and began receiving money that she paid rent with. She was also aware of a lucrative tip from authorities if the case was solved. The defense attorney brought it up under cross when Taylor testified.
2016, you said you called Detective Downs to see if there was any financial assistance. Where were you working at the time?
I wasn't.
Okay. How were you making money?
I wasn't.
Well, how were you paying your bills?
I wasn't at the time.
Okay. You had an agreement with the Lee County Sheriff's Office to testify. Do you recall that?
No, I do not recall that.
Ma'am, do you recall having your deposition taken in this case?
Yeah.
You remember I came up to Missouri, mm-hmm. We sat down, we took the day. Mm-hmm. Was that about November 28th of 2018?
Yes.
Okay. And do you remember swearing to tell the truth?
Yes.
Okay. Do you recall having an agreement with law enforcement?
Somewhat? I mean, it wasn't like, and I don't know how to explain it. I don't remember them asking to agree to do it. I just remember going forward and telling them that I wanted to help with it.
Okay. And further, you agreed to testify against Mr. Sievers, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And you don't recall whether or not Jimmy actually told you if there was going to be any money or not any money or any specific amount, correct?
I remember it being $10,000 whenever he got back.
Okay. And do you remember a $55,000 from Crime Stoppers? Do you remember that number?
Yes.
Okay. And do you anticipate that at the conclusion of this case, if Mr. Sievers is convicted, you will receive $55,000?
No.
Okay. Is it that you don't remember the $55,000 from Crime Stoppers, or you don't remember if you're going to receive the $55,000?
I remember the $55,000 being mentioned, but I don't remember if they said that I would receive it.
Okay. Why do you remember the $55,000 from Crime Stoppers?
I just remember them mentioning it on the porch whenever they came to question.
Who's they?
The detectives.
Okay. And so when they're talking to you, they said that there's $55,000 in money from Crime Stoppers out there. Is that correct?
Yes, they did.
Okay. And that you might be eligible to get some of that $55,000 if you cooperate. Is that correct?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
In their closing arguments, the defense said there is one important question that has not yet been answered.
And here's the one thing, one question no one's answered. Why? Why? Why is Teresa Sievers dead? The best answer we can give you is she is dead because Curtis Wainwright killed her. They put on a great case with respect to the guilt of Curtis Wainwright and Jimmy Ray Rogers. Does anybody have a reasonable doubt they did it? But how does that corroborate conspiracy with Mark Sievers?
The defense reminded the jury that Curtis was an ex-offender himself, with a traumatic brain injury that left him with a bipolar diagnosis. Curtis had also changed his version of events and denied his involvement several times before finally agreeing to testify against Mark in exchange for the deal. The defense attorney accused Curtis of conforming his story to fit with the sheriff's theories.
When you weigh the evidence and you look at all these facts, ultimately, the one question you all have to ask yourselves, do you trust Curtis Wainwright? And would you feel different if a polygraph had been administered? Mark Sievers is innocent. And accordingly, you should return a verdict of not guilty for one count of first-degree murder and not guilty for one count of conspiracy to commit murder.
The jury deliberated for 4.5 hours before reaching their verdict. Mark Sievers, guilty on both charges. After the verdict, Mark's mom, Bonnie Sievers, petitioned the court on behalf of her son.
So you love your son?
Very much. He's very caring, very kind, very thoughtful, always wanting to make sure you're okay. And
your son was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Would you continue to support him?
Of course. He's my baby. He's my son. And I would always be there for him.
Mark was sentenced to death. At the start of 2020, he was transferred to death row outside Jacksonville, Florida. He has since filed an appeal to the Florida Supreme Court. In 2019, the Sievers house on Jarvis Road was sold at a foreclosure auction. Photographs on Realtor.com gave a glimpse into the house in happier times. The photographs online featured a modern-looking kitchen with shiny granite countertops and a spacious 3-car garage. The scenes where the tragedy had once unfolded. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. Before I go, I have a small announcement. I've started an official YouTube channel for Court Junkie. I used to be active on YouTube years ago, back when Court Junkie was just a website, but then it sat dormant for a few years until now. I just posted a video talking about my experience filming the TV show 2020, and I'll be uploading more videos soon. I'm also going to be starting a sort of laid-back show on there, where myself and a friend discuss different court cases and crimes, and hopefully you guys like it. So check that out and subscribe at youtube.com/courtjunkie. And remember, if you want to hear these episodes without the ads and to check out additional Court Junkie content, go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will take you to my Patreon page. And that's all. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. Nowadays, coloring your hair in the comfort of your own home sounds pretty great. But I know you're probably wondering how you would find the right color, and then what about the price? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. It wasn't too long ago when you only had two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon. Well, now Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. What makes Madison Reed's color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And don't worry, finding the perfect shade is easy. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and you take their quiz that will ask you things like what you want your end result to be, what your hair texture is, and then they match you with your perfect shade. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. And now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT.